Now we continue reading in the book of Exodus in the 20th chapter, the chapter which deals with the Ten Commandments. And last Wednesday evening we confined ourselves to the first table of the law, as it is called, the first four commandments. And tonight we turn to the second table of the law, beginning at verse 12. May I just remind you one or two things that we said last time by way of introduction. It is a misunderstanding of the Ten Commandments to suppose that they represent law as over against grace. The chapter begins with a statement of grace. I am the Lord thy God, who have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. That is to say, the commandments do not stand in the scripture in terms of this do and thou shalt live, but rather they describe the way in which a redeemed people are expected to live by the God who has redeemed them. And that, of course, makes it clear that the Ten Commandments are just as applicable in that sense to Christian people today. And they describe not a way of salvation, because that was the tragic misunderstanding of the law, but rather a description of how a redeemed people should live. And that's always how we need to think of the law. And if we don't think of them like that, then think of the law like that, then we misunderstand it. The other thing, we pointed out that the two tables of the law, the first four commandments, thou shalt have no other God before me, thou shalt not make thee any graven image, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, and remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. These are Godward commandments. They have a Godward reference, whereas the other six commandments have a reference manward in the sense that they relate to the horizontal living of our lives as opposed to the vertical. Honor, verse 12, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. So we turn tonight to the second table of the law. And it's interesting to and significant to see that man's first social duty, if you can call it that, lies within the context of the family. How children and young people behave towards their parents. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land. As Paul says, it is the first commandment that has a promise attached to it, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God give thee. We'll deal with that in a moment or two. Now, there are a number of important considerations here in this commandment. Honor thy father and thy mother. This commandment is taken up by Paul in two of his epistles, Colossians 3 and 20, and Ephesians 6 and 1. And he uses it and speaks of it in terms of obedience. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. So that as far as Paul's concerned, the Old Testament commandments are not abrogated in the new economy of grace, but they're made just as binding. Honor thy father and thy mother was said to the people of God in olden time. Obey your parents in the Lord. But I think it needs to be pointed out that to honor is not quite the same as to obey. Paul qualifies the idea of obedience with the words, in the Lord. And we can learn from that that when a young person's duty to parents in obeying them conflicts with his duty to God, not only ought he to obey God rather than his parents, but in fact he will ultimately honor his parents more by obeying God and disobeying them than in obeying them against the will of God. Now, this is an important distinction here. That doesn't ever give young people the right to ride roughshod over their parents' feelings and affections. And certainly our Christian profession doesn't entitle young people to be unnecessarily offensive or even offensive at all. And even in matters of decisive disagreement with our parents' point of view, it is possible and sometimes it is necessary for disagreement to take place. But then it's possible to disobey them honorably. And we always have to see to it that it is honorable and not dishonorable disobedience that characterizes us. Now, I think there are one or two important considerations here. Take the case, for example, of a young person who professes faith in Christ. They go home full of it and tell their parents, and they may find very little sympathy and understanding of this experience into which they've entered. And they may indeed encounter opposition or contempt. It's a common enough experience. Now, the temptation there, you see, is for young folk to react violently against the parental attitude and to start preaching at their parents, sometimes very unwisely, creating a turmoil that could have been avoided if they'd been a little more patient and circumspect about it. I've had a fair bit of experience of young people who've done this, and indeed of parents that it has been done to, and I can appreciate the very difficult and tense situations that arise. We mustn't hide our light under a bushel, of course. But I think it's true to say that young people are far more likely to make an impression on their parents by the quality of their lives than by any number of words that they might utter and any number of vehement and earnest exhortations. The thought of young folk, as they sometimes do, confidently telling their parents that they're all wrong spiritually and that they're hell-deserving sinners is not a very happy thought. You may remember what the Apostle Peter says about Christian wives and their best attitude towards their unconverted husbands. And Peter suggests that they shouldn't preach to their unconverted husbands, but rather live the Christian life before them, that they may be won over without a word being spoken. They, without the word, might become believers. And I think that's just as true for young people also. Let me tell you of something that, an experience I had just a week or two ago. A good friend of mine in Ulster phoned me one morning and told me that his father was very seriously ill and had developed terminal cancer. And he was very concerned as to how he could speak to his father about spiritual things. He had been a church-going man, but there had never been any real communication as to where he stood spiritually, and understandably, the man was very concerned. And we discussed it a little bit, and I said, you know, it's really very difficult to speak about spiritual things to your parents. It's a very sensitive area, and it's an area where a lot of misunderstanding is liable to arise. And I told him about my brothers and my own relationship to our father. When we spoke to him in the early days, the only effect it had was to embarrass him horribly. And it was clear to us that whatever else could be done, that wasn't the way to win our father. And I told him that I had we had decided just to befriend him, and we had a great relationship with him in his old age, much closer than we had had in our youth in every way. And he began coming to church with us, and without our saying things, we could see a remarkable change taking place in his life. And it was very wonderful and very thrilling and very comforting to us to see the hand of God on his life. And I told this man about that. And he said, well, and I said something to the effect that, pray that God will give you a natural opportunity to speak. Don't force it. But pray that God will open the way somehow. And he said, well, thank you, I'll do that. Well, he phoned me a day or two later. I think it was a day or two, perhaps 3 or 4 days later. And he said, I must tell you about an extraordinary thing. He said, remember I spoke to you about my father? Yes, I said. I've been thinking about you. And he said, well, you know, I was visiting him. And in the most natural way in the world, spiritual things came up. And my father began to speak about spiritual things and about the Lord. And it was just a wonderful answer to prayer. Now, it could so easily have gone the other way. And injudicious, unwise, intemperate approach might have done far more harm than good. And it seems to me that there's a lot there that this commandment takes into consideration in relation to the particular problem of young folk who know the Lord and they have worries and concerns about their parents. Well, there may be young folk like that in church tonight. Let me just say this. I believe in the grace of the covenant. Peter said on the day of Pentecost, the promises to you and to your children. And I believe that when God touches a man's heart, the promise belongs as of right to his family also. But I also believe that that works backwards the other way. And that when children are converted to Christ, there is a purpose of grace for a family, not an individual only. And I believe with all my heart that when young folk are converted, it may be the door into a whole family. And I believe that young folk have to believe for this and in their prayers claim their folks for God. And when we take that attitude of faith and trust in the covenant, it robs the situation of any wrong anxiety. And therefore, it lessens the danger of intemperate and unwise preaching to old folks that may just get their backs up and do more harm than good. That's the one situation. And the other situation is in relation, of course, to the pressures and the oppositions that young people get from parents. And I think that's the point at which the phrase that Paul uses, obey your parents in the Lord, which lays a qualification upon obedience. And in such a situation, to obey God rather than men may well honor our parents more than by obeying them at the price of disobeying God. But here again, it has to be honorable disobedience, not dishonorable obedience. I remember a student who came around Holyrood in the early days, who had been converted to the Billy Graham Crusade. She was an only child. And she went home and preached hellfire to her father and mother, who thought that she had gone off her head and were terribly worried and terribly concerned and very opposed to this whole business of religion with which she seemed to have become dangerously infected. And it was a very unhappy family situation. The young girl spoke to me about it, and I tried to counsel her in the kind of way that I've been describing tonight. And I also, as a matter of fact, had occasion to have sessions with both her parents. And I discovered that it wasn't so much opposition to the gospel on the part of her parents that made them react so violently. It was simply that they loved their lassie, and they were terrified that something awful had happened to her. I remember spending most of an afternoon with her father, trying to reassure him that there was nothing wrong mentally with his daughter, and that she was saner now than she had ever been before. And I tried to reassure him. I was very amused towards the end of the afternoon when he said to me, "You're a Baptist minister, of course, aren't you?" And I blinked and said, "A Baptist minister? How dare you?" I said, "No, I'm not a Baptist minister. I'm a Church of Scotland minister." And he couldn't take it in that a Church of Scotland, a Presbyterian minister, could be saying the sort of things that I had been saying to him. That's an aside. That was just one of the funny things about that interview. But I've often felt that an awful lot of the aggro that arose in that family could easily have been avoided with a wise and sensible approach on that lassie's behalf, if she hadn't gone home and preached hellfire to her folk, if she hadn't taken them to task, but rather had sought to live out her new faith and show them by the grace of the Lord Jesus that was evident and should have been evident in her life, it might have been a very different story. Honour thy father and thy mother. Now, just a word before we go on. The first commandment with promise, as Paul puts it, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. And Paul clearly indicates here that prosperity and long life will come to those who take this commandment seriously. And I think we can say that the converse is also true. Those who dishonor their parents may well prematurely shorten their lives and bring misfortune upon themselves. That's something that's not always realized, and it might be interesting to do some study on that thought. But here is the first commandment with promise. Then, thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Now, there's an interesting link up in these commandments. Let me just point them out, point that link up before we go on to some detail. Man's person is sacred. Therefore, thou shalt not kill. Man's family life is sacrosanct. Therefore, thou shalt not commit adultery, which destroys the family. man's property is inviolate. Therefore, thou shalt not steal. You see the link up in these three commandments? Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. The Old Revised Version translates verse 13, thou shalt do no murder. And I think that's a useful distinction to make, because there is a distinction between killing and murder. Killing refers more to the accidental taking of life. Murder refers to the intentional taking of life. And what is in view here is the intentional taking of life. Thou shalt not commit murder. Now, the point, as I indicate, that's being made here is that of the sanctity of human life as belonging to God, given by Him, and to be taken only by Him. Now, there are those who think that this must necessarily exclude any possibility of capital punishment, and think that capital punishment therefore cannot be in accordance with biblical ethics. But that, it seems to me, is a confusion of thought. I know that there are differing views about capital punishment, but it is clear from both the Old Testament and the New Testament that judicial power is vested in magistrates to exact the supreme penalty. And Paul takes this up in Romans chapter 13 in the well-known words, the powers that be are ordained of God, and it's there that he speaks about the magistrates bearing not the sword in vain. He is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. It's not always realized that if the argument against capital punishment is valid and sound, that argument really applies to any punishment of any kind. Have you thought of that? If it is wrong to have capital punishment, the question arises whether it is wrong to have any punishment. Now, I think underlying this whole issue is the question of what punishment is supposed to be thought of as. Is it corrective, remedial, reformative only? Or is there any place for the idea of retribution? And if punishment is only corrective, or remedial, or reformative, then obviously capital punishment is unthinkable. For the death penalty ipso facto excludes the possibility of future reformation. But what needs to be understood is that an essential element in punishment is retribution. C.S. Lewis once wrote a letter to T.S. Eliot, the famous literary man and writer, saying, "The modern view of punishment, by excluding the retributive element and concentrating solely on deterrence and cure, is hideously immoral. It is vile tyranny to submit a man to compulsory cure or sacrifice him to the deterrence of others, unless he deserves it." Some of you may know the famous essay that Lewis wrote on the inhumanity of humanitarianism. And he deals with this whole matter at great length. I think it is one of the most brilliant and lucid of all Lewis's writings. And he points out that any idea of submitting somebody to reformation or correction is necessarily immoral unless he deserves it. And if he deserves it, then that's the only moral basis on which any punishment can be administered. Now, think that through. The alternatives, you see, are really horrific. We see the alternatives in Russia today. Men are put in psychiatric wards, and their only crime is dissidence. They have objected to the totalitarian rule, and they are given and submitted to a course of correction. And that can go on and on and on and on indefinitely. Whereas a sentence passed on the ground of desert, because a man deserves it, is necessarily limited. But if you're going to correct a man, you can prolong that in such an inhuman way. And this, of course, is what has happened many of the dissidents in Russia who have been subjected to the most terrible indignities. Now, this is something that the sentimentalists haven't really grasped in our society. They speak about remedial methods. They speak about correction. They speak about reformation, as if this were enlightened and humane. But unless people deserve it, there's no moral basis for doing it at all. And what the humane and enlightened people are doing is horribly immoral and has no kind of justification. Now, this is something that has almost gone out in modern thinking. I recall some years ago editorials in the Scotsman dealing with this whole matter of punishment. And they spoke in terms of any kind of punishment of this nature as being simply revengeful, barbaric, and pleaded for an enlightened, humane attitude. But the question, you see, is whether or not a man deserves to be punished. That's the only moral basis for punishment. Retribution is, in biblical terms, the central reality in any idea of punishment. Now, this is not to vindicate capital punishment as such, and I'm not really concerned to speak overmuch about that. I know that there's a big issue involved in all this, but I think we need to get our thinking clear and straight on the whole matter of what constitutes an ethical and moral attitude to punishment. And it's only on the ground that a man deserves to be punished that there is any justification for punishment at all. Of course there are these other aspects involved, but this is the heart of the matter. Now, that may have brought all sorts of questions into your mind, but it's not a bad thing to have things stirring up your mind and making you think like that. So we'll go on to the next one. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Here is a commandment that is designed to preserve and to maintain the sanctity of marriage and family life. And it's because in marriage a man and a woman are made one flesh that adultery is so unthinkable, for it violates and vitiates something that God has brought into being. I am pretty sure you know that this notion of two people being made one flesh is a very profound mystery that, so far as I know, hasn't really been looked at and examined at depth from a doctrinal and theological point of view. I think that holds the key to a great many things in personal relationships. Jesus said, they two shall be one flesh. That is to say, in a marriage, God creates a new thing. Something new and uniquely new is brought into being. And it's that makes any attack on marriage such a terrible and mortal offense. And I think we need to get back more and more to the biblical ideas involved in this. Jesus, of course, took this commandment and went to the heart of it when he said, I say unto you that whoso looketh on a woman to lust hath committed adultery in his heart. You can commit adultery three ways, according to Jesus: by an act, by a look, by a thought. And in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus underlined that tremendous reality. Jesus said in another place, out of the heart proceedeth adulteries, fornication, lasciviousness. And surely there could hardly be greater need for such a reminder than today. For the whole of our society has fallen victim to the commercialism of highly efficient and skilled business interests, intent upon making profit from the lusts that have been fanned in the hearts of men. Cinema, television, press, all alike pander to this. And the incitements to impurity, you see, in the imagination, are legion today. And this is why Christians have to be very clear in their minds and hearts about the things they read and the things they see. And remember that it comes into your sitting room. There's an incumbent need in society, and particularly from the Christian point of view, for men and women, and perhaps especially young men and women, who are proud of the ideal of chastity, and proud and unafraid to stand for it in face of the ridicule of their fellows, and bear testimony in this way that it's not loss, but gain, to die to sin and to the tendency to impurity and uncleanness, which is a reality for all of us. True life and fulfillment lie not in the gratification, but in the transformation of lawless and imperious instincts within us. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Then thou shalt not steal. There's the other thing. Man's person is sacred, therefore no killing. Man's family life is sacrosanct, therefore there can be no invasion of the family bond. You know, I feel that if Christians were to hold to this at whatever cost, it would make a very great difference. One of the things that is troubling many Christian ministers today is the growing incidence of marriage breakdown among Christian families and in evangelical families. It's almost becoming an accepted thing. And my point is that it should never, ever be regarded as an accepted thing or an acceptable alternative. I've told you before about a story I heard about a mother of a bride who whispered to her daughter as she went into the car that took her away on her honeymoon, "Remember, dear, if it doesn't work out, you can always get a divorce." To say that on a girl's wedding day. Now, see, that is an attitude of life that is widespread. And it is becoming increasingly common for Christians to think like that. We are told that in the American scene and in evangelical life in America, it is quite acceptable for evangelical people to be married and divorced and married again and divorced again and remarried the third time. And it's quite accepted. It's just regarded as something unfortunate. We were incompatible. That's one of the most dastardly words that have been brought into British legislature. This notion of incompatibility. I well remember a Highlandman who was in my year at college, and we were travelling up from Edinburgh to Aberdeen together in the train, and we were discussing a marriage breakdown, and he said something that I've always remembered. There are very, very, very few people, he said, who couldn't get on together if they really tried hard. And I believe that's true. But today, you see, the incompatibility notion comes in at the drop of a hat. The first disagreement, the first difference of opinion. Oh, we're incompatible. And the wedding vows have been changed from "till death us do part" to "until love dies." What on earth has that got to do with it? Vows are made before God until death us do part. And when that is established as the basic and fundamental reality, it develops a certain attitude in people's hearts. And a vow, you see, is something and has to be something that you can keep. It's got nothing to do with feelings. We cannot promise to love, but we can promise to be faithful. You cannot promise never to have another headache as long as you live, because headaches don't come into that kind of category. But you can promise to do something that involves your will. And when a man or a woman says, "I will," when they take vows, that's something they are able to do and that they ought to do, and God requires them to do it. That's the line there. Thou shalt not steal. Now, the scriptures recognize a man's right to own private property. And the scriptures are prepared to safeguard that right zealously. No man has the right to appropriate unlawfully another's property, whether that property be money or valuables or reputation or character. And of course, stealing can apply to all these things. Campbell Morgan once said that ultimately there are only three ways of possessing anything. One, by free gift from another. Two, by toil and labor. And three, by theft. And the eighth commandment recognizes the first two of these, by free gift from another, or by toil and labor, your own hard work. And it forbids the third. We steal, according to scriptures, when we appropriate for our own use what doesn't belong to us. a worker steals from his employer when he fails to give him honest and adequate work for the pay he receives. An employer steals from his employee when he fails to give adequate pay for the work he does. But a man may also steal from God, as the prophet Malachi makes very plain. Will a man rob God? Yet have he robbed me, says the Lord. When he withholds from God what is God's rightful due, either in money or time or talents, he's robbing God of what belongs to him. To appropriate for our own use what doesn't belong to us, that's stealing. Now, this is a wonderful picture of the dignity of man. Killing is forbidden because man is made in the image of God. Adultery is forbidden because it violates the sanctity of family life. Stealing is forbidden because a man has a fundamental right to his own property. And now in this next commandment, verse 17, it is in verse 16, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. It is a man's honor and character and reputation that are to be safeguarded against attack. And it's a commandment that can be broken in all sorts of ways. Perjury and slander, as well as violating the law of God, are also punishable at law, and rightly so, for they can inflict untold harm and injury on innocent people. But then, tale-bearing and gossip, with its snowballing effect, can do exactly the same, bear false witness. The creation of false impressions by innuendo, by tone of voice, by gesture, or even a knowing silence. These things can bear false witness. I remember a Christian man once speaking of a friend of mine in a company. Rather, he didn't speak, but his attitude spoke volumes. The name of my friend was mentioned, and the man said, "Ah," and shook his head. And the indelible impression that that gave to the whole company was one that was damning on my friend. And I remember burning with indignation. The man didn't say a thing. He just shook his head with a knowing smile on his face, a deprecating smile on his face. Character assassination is what we call it. And sometimes dragging it irretrievably into the mire. And hearts are often broken like that, you know. And lives sometimes brought to a premature grave by such malicious and merciless practices. Sometimes under the cloak of sanctity and a zeal for righteousness. We have to be very careful, you know, in handling the good name of our brother. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. And of course, this is where motive comes in, isn't it? If we want to believe ill of somebody, if we want what we have heard about him to be true, then we've already borne false witness against him in our hearts. And we shall soon bear false witness against him to others. The book of Proverbs says, keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. And the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet. And this, as we know, is the one that got home to Paul. I had not known sin, he said, except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. And of course it points to the true understanding of the matter as being inward rather than outward. And this shows where all the commandments have their real thrust, the inward attitude of heart and thought. That's where obedience to them must be fulfilled. Thou shalt not covet. To covet unlawfully. And the very word sounds horrible, doesn't it? Thou shalt not covet. We dress it up, of course. We excuse it. We legitimize it. When a man covets his neighbor's wife, he doesn't think of it in terms of coveting. He thinks of it in terms of the great and grand passion, and this is so right. Him. When all the time it's a contemptible, selfish, sleazy, lustful thing that he's doing. But he doesn't think of it like that. He clothes it in all romantic, sentimental notions. It's worth noting in this regard the coveting business something that C.S. Lewis says so pointedly, that the essence of a wrong desire is not only that it will not be satisfied, but that it cannot be satisfied. The more it is fed, the more voracious and craving does the appetite become. And even if it were given the whole creation, it would want still more. It is all-consuming, and it's born of hell itself. And that's why a covetous spirit that hankers after what must ever in the nature of things be out of its reach is so soul-destroying and disintegrating. Some people eat their hearts out for what they can never hope to attain or possess. And that develops a canker of discontentment. Do you know, the most discontented person I ever met was an evangelical Christian lady who lived in the lap of luxury and was never satisfied with what she had. She had a beautiful house, but she wanted a more beautiful one and got it. And her poor, long-suffering husband was led a merry dance. A sad but merry dance. And she went from one discontentment to another, coveting something better, reaching out. It was a disease. It was like looking at a terminal cancer. It was an ugly, horrible thing to see. And you could see it on her face. She had a discontented look about her that made people want to shy clear of her. Well, that's the sadness about it. That's the tragedy. And that's the inward thing. Thou shalt not covet. Well might the New Testament say, be content with such things as ye have, for he hath said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. We sometimes call it keeping up with the Joneses. Coveting place or position, possessions or recognition. And in so doing, making our own lives and indeed the lives of everybody else around us miserable in the atmosphere of discontentment that we create. God help us. God save us. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. And then these words, and with this we close. And the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. And they said unto Moses, speak thou with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die. And Moses said, fear not, for God is come to prove you, and that his fear may be for your faces, that ye sin not. And the people stood afar off, and Moses drew near unto the thick darkness where God was. Now here's two kinds of fear, you see. Fear inspired by the presence of the living God. Craven fear, born of unsubmissive hearts and spirits. And godly fear that longs to draw near and worship and fall down before him. With Israel, the fear of this omnipresent God expressed itself in a desire to escape. They stood back. They stood apart, afar off. In the kind of way in which Adam and Eve sought to hide themselves from the presence of God in the Garden of Eden. But with Moses, it was different. He found himself drawn into the thick darkness where God was. Moses was afraid, and yet he wasn't afraid. And it's paradoxically at those times when we most fear God in the right way that we realize we most love him. And most drawn to him, Moses drew near. He was a sinner too. But the attitude was different, and he drew near to the thick darkness where God was. Oh, there's so much in that chapter. We've only scratched the surface of it. I commend it to your further study. Now a word of prayer.